Chapter 2. Culture. S.C. Allen, chairman of National Cash Register, would often tell a story about his company's early days. He had survived World War II, and in 1945 became one of the first civilians allowed back into Germany to check on his factories. Upon arrival, he found that one of the factories had been obliterated. His employees were there, sifting through the rubble in tattered clothes, but when they saw Allen, they smiled and hugged, at least according to Allen's telling, and immediately got to the work of rebuilding. The moral of the story, and the reason the chairman so often repeated it, was that company culture was uniquely resilient. The war had torn through the country, leaving destruction and death in its wake, but NCR's employees remained loyal, dedicated. A shell-shocked but productive family. This is the lead anecdote of Corporate Cultures, a seminal 1982 book by the consultants Terrence Deal and Alan Kennedy. The book was designed for executives and fellow consultants who coveted employee devotion, with stories like Alan's functioning as a sort of secular parable. But what are the rest of us supposed to take from this story? That NCR has such a durable corporate culture that it can survive literal airstrikes? Or is it that NCR's employees are so dedicated that amid unspeakable death and destruction, they feel the need not to be with or tend to family, but to help rebuild a factory? Deal and Kennedy seem to acknowledge the outlandishness of the anecdote. But that doesn't keep them from arguing that it remains one of the pantheon of the myths and legends of American business. They insist these types of stories create an environment in which employees could be secure and thereby do the work necessary to make the business a success. It's true. The actions companies and their leaders take, coupled with the stories they recount or invent, become the framework for a company's work environment, which is to say, its culture. But like any story, its moral can be corrupted or leveraged for ill, in service of productivity, profitability, or shareholder value. At best, company culture is a clear mission statement about the organization's goals, for its product, but also for how it treats its employees. Procter & Gamble's company culture statement begins, for example, with this sentence. P&G is driven to make life better, not just within the company, but across the globe. Netflix claims, "We value integrity, excellence, respect, inclusion, and collaboration." Deloitte's shared beliefs include lead the way, serve with integrity, take care of each other, and foster inclusion. All of these sound good in theory, but in most organizations, there's long been a disconnect between the stated company culture and the way employees experience that culture on an everyday basis. Actual corporate culture is the ineffable feeling you get working at a place. It can be, everyone is expected to show up on weekends, or no one is expected to show up on weekends. Going to HR will help change things, or going to HR means you'll never get promoted again. It can take the form of unwritten rules, passed down in hushed office chats or via after-work drinks or text messages, and manifest itself in the cornucopia of company reviews on Glassdoor. Sometimes bad culture is explicit, and it's no secret that employees are expected to grind themselves into the ground in service of profits. But sometimes a cheery paragraph on a website functions as a smokescreen for exploitation, exclusion, and generally shitty workplace practices. If your organization is family-friendly, and you quietly encourage female managers to limit the number of childbearing age women on their team, you have a bad company culture. If one of your values is inclusion, but making an office fully accessible feels too expensive, you have bad company culture. If you're a law firm with a month's paid time off and no one taking more than a week or two, you have bad company culture. Company cultures solidify slowly, taking form over years and decades. But they're often treated as intractable, even though there's nothing natural or obligatory about culture. It's just as much a construct as the need for corner offices or time cards. Still, we should be prepared that any attempt to actually decenter work's place in our lives or make work more flexible will feel like a threat to that culture. Because it is. This will be the recurring question from leaders, managers, and employees alike. Sure, we'd love to have people have more flexibility with where and how they work, they'll say. But what about our company culture? This reaction elides an uncomfortable truth. in so many organizations, that culture sucks. It is toxic or repressive or stultifying, even if no one dares say it out loud. And while executives set the tone and parameters for that culture, it is enforced and reproduced up and down the organizational structure by managers. Early in our interviews for this book, we spoke with Adam Siegel, CEO of Cove, a company that helps coordinate shared desk and conference space. The future of work, he said, is actually having to manage people. He was referring to the fact that in the past, most management took place in person, and now managers would need to figure out how to have conversations and judge performance from afar. But the comment stuck with us. It's not just that managers will need to modify their existing tactics. Instead, organizations will need to rethink the purpose that management has served over the years, and all the largely impossible roles it's asked to fulfill today. The role of the manager has become hopelessly overdetermined. In pop culture, they're at once useless and overly powerful. In practice, they're usually overworked and undertrained. But you cannot build a new work culture for yourself, for your team, or for your entire company without them. We have so few models of good management, let alone good company culture, in our past or our present. The reason is pretty straightforward. The stated and unstated goals of an organization have rarely aligned with the health or stability of the employee, creating a chasm that no amount of management can correct. It's not that the organization wants profits so much as the organization wants as much profit as possible, with little regard to the effect that that demand places on the employee. What follows then is a parable of our own, of what becomes of company culture when profits and optimization begin to preclude all else, the feelings of alienation and precarity that follow, and how to begin the slow but essential process of bridging that divide. Flexible work won't fix your work culture, but the management practices, trust, and accountability that accumulate around it have real potential to transform it. Manage your productivity. Read enough books on the history of work and you'll see the same theme emerge again and again. Humans crave meaning and dignity, and one way some of them find it is through the completion of necessary tasks, aka work. But these same meaning-craving humans also bristle at the idea of modern work, the hauling of oneself to a location and then toiling for someone else for a set number of hours. Work can be satisfying, in other words, but who wants to do it all the time and on someone else's schedule? This was the problem that early management was designed to solve. Did not go over well with the rank and file. I found the utmost distaste on the part of the men to any regular hours or regular habits, a 19th century English hosiery manufacturer wrote. The men themselves were considerably dissatisfied because they could not go in and out as they pleased, and have what holidays they pleased, and go on just as they had been used to do. And why wouldn't they be dissatisfied? Pre-industrial labor was by no means easy, but much of it could be done on a worker's own terms. Forced into formalized, factory-like arrangements, laborers viewed six-hour workdays as onerous, and perhaps only temporary until desired productivity had been achieved. Attendance was poor. Something had to be done to condition the workforce to perform strenuous labor on behalf of others. Owners began to impose fines and strict oversight because, as the social psychologist Shoshana Zuboff points out, workers submitted to the physical rigors of factory discipline only when other alternatives had been exhausted. Early factory designs were modeled after workhouses and prisons. Positive reinforcement was attempted, but the carrot was usually abandoned for the stick, even when it came to the children who increasingly filled the workforce. Early corporate culture, in other words, was built on a foundation of intimidation, paired with punitive measures used to condition the human body to submit to repetitive tasks day in and day out. This culture of physical coercion is still prevalent in exploitative workplaces today, from shipping warehouses to sweatshops, but it's a blunt, unpredictable mode of enforcing productivity. The development of modern capitalism, as we'll explain, required something more surgical. That form of management arrived at the turn of the 20th century from the mind of a mechanical engineer named Frederick Winslow Taylor. As an employee for Bethlehem Steel, Taylor lamented that workers were naturally lazy, and in order to counter their slovenly attitudes, he began to closely study their movements. He realized that coal shovelers with standardized shovel sizes could haul more weight without getting tired quickly. He timed others' movements on the factory floor with a stopwatch, looking for extraneous movements to shave off their routines. He was often brazenly manipulative. While monitoring pig iron haulers, he experimented with daring the strongest loaders to load as fast as they could. When they finished the task quickly, he concluded that first-class men could be hauling far more per day, provided they just worked a little faster and without as much rest. Taylor believed that perfect productivity was possible. Redundancies were everywhere, and there was always room for optimization. This should all sound familiar, even if we're far from the floor of Bethlehem Steel. And just as with today, it made employees miserable. "We don't want to work as fast as we're able to," one machinist debating Taylor in 1914 declared. "We want to work as fast as we think it's comfortable for us to work. We haven't come into existence for the purpose of seeing how great a task we can perform through a lifetime. We are trying to regulate our work so as to make it auxiliary to our lives." Over time, Taylor's theories were dubbed scientific management, a moniker that helped rationalize the cold, unforgiving, unemotional treatment of subordinates with an aura of empirical credibility. His ideas continued to spread with little regard to critics who argued he was making up or misinterpreting his own data. For managers, the prospect of applying science to the world of industry was simply too intoxicating, especially when it forced laborers' goals to align with the company's. And like so many business theories to come, Taylorism was taught and codified through the academy. Taylor is the mortar of every American business school, the historian Jill Lepore wrote in 2009. Devotees of Taylorism took his teachings even further. Management engineers Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, for example, used early cameras to watch workers. The field, dubbed motion study, reduced labor down to around 17 distinct motions. The goal was to eliminate waste motion. This supercharged form of management gave supervisors the tools to obsessively surveil and quantify their employees' every move. Within Taylorism, the more data you had, the more control you could exercise, the better. But it could not be maintained without a supply of competent, loyal workers and a rigid hierarchical order to keep them from resisting the dehumanizing scientific methods of their superiors. Enter the middle manager. Taylor called this role functional supervision. In practice, it meant a series of foremen, each with his own specialization. The gang boss, who operates as a foreman surveying operations, or the disciplinarian, enforcing the rote, efficient rhythms of the workday. It's also worth noting that this intense focus on optimization spread outside work, as well as into the home. As Lepore noted in her 2009 piece, office efficiencies didn't contribute to more leisure time at home. They made domestic life more hectic. "Scientific management isn't the kind of thing you can leave at the office," she wrote. Taylorism would evolve over the years to come as management theory, embrace the understanding that positive attention could also compel employees to work harder. In the 1930s, for example, business theorist Chester Barnard defined good managers as value shapers concerned with the informal social properties of an organization. In other words, creating culture. Instead of eagle-eyed foremen glaring down at hunched laborers, managers were newly conceived of as organizational stewards, charged with maintaining productivity, but also the emotional well-being of their employees. Today, the legacy of Taylorism is most visible in employee monitoring computer software, which not only screenshots the websites and employee visits, but calculates how much time is spent typing and moving the mouse, something we'll talk about later. But it is also present in the managerial process of gathering and analyzing data, and in the idea that perfect productivity is possible if you just magically find a balance between pushing workers to their breaking point and not running them into the ground. Maintaining that balance has proven treacherous, if not impossible. Those at the top of an organization often lack proximity to the vast majority of their employees, which means they have only the vaguest understanding of what's happening in their day-to-day work lives. The task of maintenance thus falls to managers, who serve as the connective tissue between the top and bottom of an organization. The product that managers transmit back and forth is, in some form, the company's culture. They're its primary conduit. No one, not even the CEO, touches, shapes, or directs it more. the organization man. As office work began to expand over the course of the 20th century, workers were sold on promises of comfort and satisfaction. Instead of toiling on a factory room floor, welding the same joint over and over again, you could sit in an office, filing the same report over and over again. Your collar, as Upton Sinclair famously put it, would be white. Your work, at least in the vast majority of cases, would be salaried and steady. After the prolonged, destabilizing trauma of the Depression and World War II, you can see how those offerings would be immensely appealing. The corporation offered not just financial safety, but a sense of belonging, both to a corporation and its mission, and to the rapidly expanding middle class and its attendant cultural trappings. Just as millions of returned GIs flocked to civic organizations, from the Elks to the Rotary Club, hoping to duplicate the feeling of collective mission, many workers were equally eager to give themselves over to the larger corporate effort, with the promises of making their everyday lives feel meaningful. A new sort of company culture, embodied by the so-called organization man, began to grow around this feeling. The journalist William White coined the term in his 1956 best-selling book to describe a specific genre of competent middle-class office worker. Employed in the offices of companies like GM, General Electric, and 3M, he was not destined for the corner office, but he was okay with that. He worked hard and had faith that the benefits of good work would trickle both up and down the corporate ladder. This, again, was a symptom of the age, when feelings of collectivism, so foreign to our current highly individualized moment, were at an all-time historical high. The organization man was confident, White noted, that the goals of the individual and the goals of the organization would work out to be one and the same. The company culture that sprang forth was one of loyalty and trust, in both one's leaders and one's peers. Which is part of why reading White's book today feels like peering into some foreign utopian land. The organization man is, well, satisfied. He's not ambitious, but he's not lazy either. He's eager to maintain a semblance of non-work life and uninterested in distinguishing himself. Trainees hope to rise high and hope just as much not to suffer the personal load of doing so, White writes. Frequently, they talk of finding a sort of plateau, a position well enough up to be interesting, but not so far up as to have one's neck outstretched for others to chop at. But the dark side of post-war office culture is right there in that sentence. Make yourself known, by thinking differently, by challenging the status quo, by rising too quickly, and make yourself a target. Individuality wasn't just discouraged, it was tantamount to career suicide. The goal was to keep your head down. Do what was expected of you, but nothing more, and encourage others to do the same. Workers conformed, but they did so, according to White, with a placid smile. They were undergirded by real support, whether in the form of their salary, their pension, or their enduring job security. It is not the evils of organization life that puzzle him, but its very beneficence, White explained. He is imprisoned in brotherhood. And that imprisonment extended to the home, where the ethos of organization man culture was instrumental in shaping the structures of white middle-class life. Early suburbs were quite literally built to accommodate and incubate organization men, their families, and their social lives, which became appendages of the company. Social status was cemented through perks like local country club memberships, while the organization man's family, especially his wife, became a form of corporate asset, valued for her ability to host and socialize. Employees were expected to leverage their family life to woo clients and executives alike. Actually, it's hard to tell where the workday ends and the pleasure begins, one manager told White. If you count all the time required for cocktails, dinners, conferences, and conventions, there is no end to work. I think any responsible executive these days works practically all the hours he is awake. It's no coincidence that during this period, the 25 or so years following World War II, the idea of a career became a staple of the white-collar world. Unlike a job or a gig, a career is above all else strategic and demands not just work, but appropriate assimilation into workplace culture. A career entails showing up every day and putting in concentrated hours and wholeheartedly leaning into a company's ethos, distinguishing yourself and disappearing. It calls for the concerted, eager sublimation of the self to the corporate good, but also a deft charting of one's path through the organization. Be ambitious, but appropriately so. This sort of contradictory messaging is a hallmark of toxic company culture, in part because it outlines a vanishingly small line for employees to tread. Which is why its primary legacy, still evident in thousands of workplaces, is a culture built on homogeneity and exclusion, where pedigree, evidenced in the form of education, family name, dress, even manner of speaking, become crucial passports. Without them, there's no way up the career ladder. No matter if some or all are unavailable to wide swaths of the population. It becomes, as one McKinsey managing director wrote, the way we do things around here. For those inside this company culture, especially those who have given themselves over to it, it starts to feel invisible, like some inevitable creation, which is convenient. It's always far harder to resist what you can't see. But nothing about this sort of company culture or any company culture is inevitable. It's designed by people and almost always oriented towards the financial interests of the company. Still, some cultures are more durable than others, better at convincing all involved, from workers and customers to leaders and shareholders, that a particular mode of operating is in everyone's best interest. The clicks, the perks, and stability that flowed from the organization man culture were very real, but its endurance sprang from the fact that it managed, however temporarily, to convince clerical workers, middle management, and executives that their interests were aligned. Like so many company cultures, it was a bit of coercive storytelling, a half-lie repeated until it felt like truth. Going to work every day might feel stultifying, even suffocating. But what more could you ask? Your family was living the American dream and would continue to live it for the foreseeable future. For the white men who could find their way into the system in the first place, it all worked pretty well. Until it didn't. We're not all in this together. Between the end of World War II and the early 1970s, the United States enjoyed a period of unprecedented economic growth and stability, what some economists refer to as the Golden Age of American capitalism. That Golden Age, and the ideas about company growth that accompanied it, made organization man office culture possible. But starting in the early 1970s, a wave of recessions and economic stagnation shook even the strongest of those companies' foundations. Behemoths of respective industries entered that decade fat and happy and naive, characteristics that, under the unforgiving eye of a slumping economy, quickly morphed into bloated, occasionally lazy, and flat-footed in the race to compete globally. Their solution, as we noted in the last chapter, was cuts. In the first 8 years of the 1980s, Fortune 500 companies cut more than 300 million jobs, many of them from the stable middle management positions that had not only helped expand the modern middle class, but functioned as the organizational centuries of culture. DuPont, Xerox, General Electric, good companies with sterling reputations, started shaving away benefits, first with temporary cuts, then with permanent ones. And then, when that didn't work, layoffs. The results were devastating. Those who'd bought into the collectivist company culture and reoriented their lives around that loyalty realized they'd been sold out. What was good for the company was no longer good for the organization man. The journalist Amanda Bennett chronicled this grisly fallout in her 1990 book, The Death of the Organization Man, which concluded that a generation of workers were lulled by paternalistic companies only to be betrayed by them the moment times got tough. Before writing the book, Bennett worked for the Wall Street Journal, covering the auto industry from Detroit. She'd watched the home offices of blue-chip car manufacturers like GM and Ford delight in the stability of the post-war economy. At Ford's executive lunchroom, for example, white-gloved men served up silver-platter lunches at $120 a plate, all subsidized by the company. Workers on the assembly line were subject to periodic layoffs and rehirings, but at HQ, jobs were plentiful. The company hired aggressively, building out labyrinthian org charts, overflowing with managers. As Bennett explains, a big part of a manager's job began to be relating to other managers, as organizations got so big and so complex that some people were hired whose job was simply to help navigate the organization. Company culture had become a hall of mirrors, a tautological story devoid of substance, We are because we are. We do because we do. It didn't take much for that hall of mirrors to collapse in on itself. As companies began to cut, loyalty often kept the organization man working against his personal interests and financial interests, Bennett writes. Dozens of managers stayed with their companies in the face of disastrous situations, working and working hard. These were the loyal soldiers, staying at their posts no matter what. These middle managers might have felt like loyal soldiers at the time, but they were blinded by loyalty and perks and a workplace family that didn't allow them to see that their battalion had been moved to the front lines in order to be sacrificed. When you create a corporate ethos in which employees base their self-worth and the very foundation of their identity on their job, removing them from that job is hard. Bennett described the ramifications of downsizing as the same as suffering a divorce or a death in the family. For the downsized, losing a job wasn't just losing financial stability, but expulsion from one's social life. Losing the physical space of the office meant disconnection from their daily rhythms and the hundreds of seemingly inconsequential actions that defined their lives. Many had been with their companies for decades and had no idea how to begin to search for new jobs. They built careers, and those careers had become their lives. Now that the career was gone, what, if anything, remained of their lives? The result was a new brand of corporate cynicism, one that has become deeply embedded in contemporary workplace culture. The lesson that many corporations took from the cuts of the 1980s and 1990s was to never again find themselves in the position of having to drastically downsize. But instead of rethinking company culture from the ground up, they opted to methodically strip the elements of corporate life that had provided stability to workers. In this global brand of cutthroat capitalism, the futurist R. Morton Darrow explained, managers who were once perceived and treated as assets were transformed into costs. The idea of working at one place for an entire career became quaint, because the specter of another round of layoffs loomed around every corner. Employees grew increasingly less loyal, with good reason. The new mantra was, it's not personal, it's business, which might have felt true if the results of business decisions weren't so personally destabilizing. Even Terrence Steele and Alan Kennedy, the same pair of consultants who, back in 1982, regaled readers with stories of NCR's hard-driving, sales-oriented culture that survived an air raid, were chastened. When times are tough, they had written in the final paragraph of Corporate Cultures, these companies can reach deeply into their shared values and beliefs for the truth and courage to see them through. In 1999, looking back from the vantage point of nearly two decades of layoffs, mergers, and outsourcing, Steele and Kennedy realized they'd been deeply wrong. They lamented the slavish dedication to shareholder value and short-term results, which both eroded and poisoned corporate culture. They decried the slide toward corporate anonymity and thoughtless management actions in pursuit of short-term goals. They could see a logic, however faulty, in the culture-demolishing cuts companies had made over the last 2 years. But now is the time to correct it. In their new book, titled The New Corporate Cultures, Steele and Kennedy had all sorts of suggestions to remotivate an unmotivated workplace, re-knit cohesive bonds, and even, as they put it, throw a little fun in the process. But their obsession with improving culture was hardly new. In fact, the pair had launched a culture craze upon the original publication of their book, which had been the first to truly articulate the phantom force, as they put it, that lay underneath the rational technical veneer of business. In the years that followed, the explicit cultivation of company culture had become a business school cure-all, as companies attempted to follow advice to cut costs and stay lean, but also, somehow, make their employees less dour and anxious about everything. As workers devoured productivity books, executives and human resources departments became obsessed with culture. They flocked to management gurus, tried out combinations of quantification and obsessive optimization, wondered if positive organization might engender more productivity. Some believed that if companies released their iron grip on employees and embraced a more democratic style of management, maybe employees would feel not just happy, but cared for, like part of a family. Instead of providing employees with actual stability, the thinking went, they'd provide them with more freedom over their own work, which would theoretically revitalize company culture. Leaders might not have been dedicated to the shifts that would actually change company culture, but they sure liked the idea of it. And they got their ideas from books. Books like The Original Corporate Cultures and In Search of Excellence, which sold more than 4.5 million copies and became defining corporate texts of the 1980s and 1990s. In Excellence, two consultants, Thomas Peters and Robert Waterman Jr., profiled dozens of companies, highlighting open-door policies and fluid organizational structures, where small bands of zealots operate outside the mainstream to come up with new strategies and products. They saw not organization men, but innovative obsessives. To support those employees, they argued that companies needed visionary managers who gave employees autonomy while also still holding the reins. As a leader, you are authoritarian or you are democratic, they advised. In reality, you are neither and both at the same time. This loose, tight management might sound enlightened. Its prime directive is, essentially, treating employees like adults. Yet in practice, managers' hold on the reins was often uncomfortably tight. The leaders Peters and Waterman venerated believed in open doors, but were also stern disciplinarians, every one. They gave plenty of rope, but they accepted the chance that some of their minions would hang themselves. A family, then, but a fairly ruthless one. Like corporate cultures, In Search of Excellence inspired a glut of knockoffs, spin-offs, and sequels in the business book section, all featuring case studies of successful corporations that appeared to have figured out the new global economy. These companies were more nimble, less stodgy, more willing to experiment. They threw parties and peculiar product launch pep rallies. Who cares about the cuts, many of which had been suggested, uncoincidentally, by consultants just like Peters and Waterman, when you have a fun atmosphere where people work and play hard? These books were billed as providing new management strategies, but they rarely touched on how to deal with your team through a leveraged buyout or manage cash flow. They weren't teaching leaders how to rebuild corporate culture so much as how to craft a cheap fix out of the wreckage that remained. These strategies rarely, if ever, offered true autonomy or equality to workers. Hierarchies were still rigid. Benefits were still a hollow echo of their previous selves. The new policies and team building and hoopla of the so-called new management were mostly a distraction from the tightness of the rope around workers' necks. Who needs middle management when you've got venture capital? If you work in a corporate environment, the legacy of these ideas about culture and management, accumulated over more than a century of business theory, surround you. They're in your open office plan, something we'll talk more about in a following chapter. But they're also in the break room, or the canteen, or catered lunches. They're in your happy hour outings that coexist with your company's refusal to match your 401k. But they're most visible and most noxious in the startup world. In The Search for Excellence, the descriptions of loose-tight practitioners from the 1980s often sound like blueprints for the Silicon Valley companies of today. At 3M, there were management groups that not only tolerated, but embraced and supported failure. Hewlett-Packard and Tupperware trumpeted flex hours and hoopla that included frequent employee jubilees. At Caterpillar, they used to dress up new earth movers in costumes and throw big parties. Even the workplace campus, now a staple of big tech, is cited as promoting a successful loose-tight company, as was the case for 3M, Kodak, Dana, Dow, P&G, and Texas Instruments. But modern startup culture will always have a slightly different DNA from the corporate behemoths, which, no matter how much hoopla they added to employee jubilees, were still built on a foundation of loyal company men. Startup company culture started from a premise of rejection, of old-school rules of decorum, dress code, and departmental organization, but also of traditional notions of innovation and growth. Instead of trying to paper over and cure the corporate cynicism of the 1970s and 1980s, startups consolidated it and used it to power entrepreneurship. No wonder business school interest in entrepreneurship boomed over the course of the 1980s. It was a new armor against the unpredictability of corporate life. It's a lack of trust that underlines entrepreneurship, the Harvard business professor Howard Stevenson observed. If they're going to foul it up, they'd rather do it themselves than rely on some idiot on Madison Avenue or something beyond their control. Success stories spurred would-be founders, even as tech bubbles swelled and burst. The scale and connectivity of the web helped nurture the belief that any person with the right idea, in the right place, at the right time, could not just achieve staggering success and wealth, but fundamentally upend or disrupt an entire industry, even with a bare-bones team operating out of their garage. It was a new, alluring version of meritocracy. Sure, the American dream was broken, but you could hack it. If there had been any doubt that individualism had subsumed the collectivist ethos of yore, the tech boom put it wholly to rest. Venture capitalists, a group often composed of the most successful disruptors, underwrote this fantasy. Along the way, they helped build what we now know as startup culture, a hybrid of old toxic corporate elements, the entrepreneurship ethos, and a celebration of new iconoclastic ideas. The industry developed a founder worship that would look familiar to the vaguely cultish inner workings at, say, IBM, whose company songbook included a song dedicated to its chairman, Thomas Watson, with the lyrics, "We know and we love you, and we know you have our welfare in your heart." But the core value was an all-consuming obsessive devotion to the company. Not just its financial success, but its greater ideal or mission, which was frequently framed in utopian language. Given the near-infinite playground of the internet and the millions if not billions of dollars of funding at stake, it wasn't enough to just build an app. You had to connect the world as never before, solve an intractable problem, reimagine an entrenched industry, disrupt the status quo. That was worth the venture capital investment, which meant it was also worth giving over one's life. Worshipping at the altar of the god of scale requires making sacrifices on behalf of the business. Squint at startup culture and you can see the vestiges of the organization man and his fealty to the greater corporate good. Tech entrepreneurs would throw their $12 IPA in your face if you called them that. Startups conceived of themselves in opposition to big business. They're companies, but they're not corporate. To prove it, many embrace an irreverent work-hard-play-hard culture. Founders indulge in a sort of extended adolescence, days-long workbenders capped off with real ones. For the most intense, this ethos served as the final destruction of any semblance of work-life balance. Complete devotion to the cause meant living in the office and transporting all of the outside elements of one's life, partying, exercise, romance, into that space. Early Silicon Valley companies had recruited engineers for decades whose personalities lent themselves naturally towards workaholism. But this was another level. As these companies grew, they'd shed some of the juvenile elements, but not the all-consuming devotion and obsession, which was valorized in the culture through the early war stories of all-night code binges and epic company parties. As startup culture became more visible and desirable, these stories consolidated into a genre, now infamously known as hustle porn. Meanwhile, a secondary hustle industry began to emerge, populated with the thought leaders and conferences dedicated to providing instructions on how to win the disruption lottery. First, you'd need an idea and the talent. After that, it was a relentless hustle and struggle. To call it a work ethic doesn't do it justice. It was the complete sublimation of a person in pursuit of a hazy idea of success. Rejecting the old-school corporate culture didn't just mean embracing small teams and ping-pong tables. It also meant doing away with the hierarchies altogether. Corporate infrastructures like HR, or even something as simple as an organizational chart, were eschewed until absolutely necessary. They were building the plane as it flew, which meant that many of the load-bearing elements of a company were installed without much thought or care. It would all prove culturally disastrous. But such structural weaknesses took time to reveal themselves, and whatever problems they did cause, at least for a time, were offset by dazzling growth and plastered over with a scrappy origin story, a founder myth, and an inflated sense of mission. Who has time to worry about middle management or org charts or HR complaints after all, when you're disrupting the world? But with time, growth, exposure to the spotlight, startups like Google, Facebook, Amazon, Uber, and hundreds of others were forced to conceive of themselves as corporations. The quirks of their culture were codified. the treatment of management as an afterthought, the hollow perks in place of actual benefits, the inattention to HR, the fetishization of productivity, and the reliance on the flexible contract workers spread across corporate campuses with elaborate free sashimi bars and complimentary laundry services, and trickled into disparate corners of the non-startup world. Today, startup culture isn't a fad or a novelty. It's the new ideal for so many companies, regardless of their product or their history. As the pandemic made abundantly clear, that culture is simply not sustainable. It's not sustainable for the individuals in and out of the office who power it. It's not sustainable for our families. And it's not sustainable for our communities or the world where we make our homes. Profits might be steady, even soaring. But the workforce, like the communities and our lived environments, is collapsing. It's worth pausing here to explain what we mean about this collapse. We understand that an executive hearing these words might see this as hyperbole. My employees aren't miserable. They don't hate me. This might be true. But the collapse we're talking about has to do with a relationship to work that's grown increasingly unsustainable. First, there's the sheer number of hours we're working. According to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the average American works more hours than the average laborer in any peer nation. But unlike many Western nations, where increased productivity and wealth tend to lead to more leisure time, Americans continue to overwork themselves despite productivity gains. The OECD found that the U.S. works 269 more hours than its enormously wealthy economy would predict, making it, by this measure, the second most overworked country in the world. Then there's how we work. Long before COVID-19 hit, Fox's Anna North writes, Americans were expected to work like they didn't have families. This expectation, however unspoken, was codified after World War II, when the office workforce, in particular, was dominated by men. In 1960, only 20% of mothers worked. By 2010, 70% of children lived in homes, where all adults were employed in some capacity. But workplace policy, particularly in the United States, has failed to evolve to fit this new reality, whether in the case of family leave policies or expectations for after-hours work. The ideal worker is still the worker with as few familial obligations as possible. For parents, and mothers in particular, attempting to contort themselves to fit that ideal, the result is stress, fatigue, burnout, and, in some cases, dropping out of the workforce entirely. Some of these expectations and failures are specific to the United States, but workers are struggling globally as well. Microsoft's 2021 Work Trend Index surveyed more than 30,000 workers in 31 countries and found that 54% reported feeling overworked, 39% felt exhausted, and 20% said that their employer didn't care about work-life balance. Even with all of this time allocated to work, global GDP has remained stagnant since 2012. According to the 2017 Gallup report, The State of the Global Workplace, 66% of adults say they're not engaged at work, and 18% say they're actively disengaged. The report argues that companies that orient performance around basic human needs for psychological engagement are most likely to get the most out of their employees. But few organizations seem to have figured this out. Instead, they stifle productivity and enthusiasm through haphazard management, a generalized lack of worker autonomy, and increasing hours and expectations that lead to worker burnout. Granted, the global workforce has not actually collapsed, and perhaps it never will. But the trends listed above seem to signal a rot at the center of the way we think about our jobs and the way we're asked to perform them. Our relationship to work is broken. Our attitudes are toxic, our demands on individuals too great. Work's rewards are not commensurate with the time spent, and many of our policies, especially in the United States, do not provide the support needed to continue as we do our jobs. These are the conditions that make collapse possible. And while it might not happen on a macro level, our reporting suggests that on an individual level, it's happening all the time, every day. In one sense, this means that if you're a manager or executive, this isn't necessarily personal. These dynamics are systemic. And many workers will rightly find that the only way to address them is through a union. But it also means that even if your employees appear satisfied with their roles and with you as their leader, they are still operating in this system. As their leader, any commitment to reevaluate and reshape our relationship to work ultimately runs through you. In this sense, it should feel deeply personal. It sounds hokey, but you have the power to significantly change people's lives. What are you going to do with it? If we go back to the office and restart the rhythms of company life as if nothing has happened, there will be a halcyon month where everyone revels in the novelty of being somewhere, anywhere, that's not their home. But the wounds of the pandemic year are still open and raw. If companies keep their focus on short-term growth, leaning on the sort of flexibility that's just code for passing risk and precarity onto workers, distrust and exhaustion will continue to grow. Managers will collapse under the burden of communicating the company's ongoing demands to a burned-out workforce. The culture, no matter its character, will rot. If it wasn't breaking before the pandemic, it will soon. But we can reject this scenario. We can understand that if companies actually want to cultivate that ever-alluring, good company culture, they have to rethink not just the amenities and office space they're providing their employees, but the entire style of work, the whole ethos of optimization and presentism. Doing so will demand authentically embracing flexibility, as we discussed in the last chapter, but it will also mean reconsidering core values beyond growth and scale, and understanding that you cannot compel or surveil your way to sustained quality productivity. Productivity is the byproduct of a workforce that has had its essential needs met. This isn't a matter of grafting a new, flashy, prepackaged idea of the culture onto your existing one. It's about rethinking what's made your culture the way it is, connecting that structure with the struggles that have followed, and thinking through how flexibility could change it. This is arduous, endlessly challenging work, but you have to till the ground before you can even begin to germinate the seeds of something new, vibrant, and capable of sustained growth. What does flexible work culture look like? Paul Hershenson doesn't do Fridays. For the last 8 years, when most people in the working world are getting itchy and starting to run out the clock on the week, Paul organizes a backpack and gets in the car. On the drive out to the wilderness from his home in San Diego, he'll maybe take a call or two. Not always, but he reserves the option. "It's a good stretch of time where I'm always available to think," he told us when we got a hold of him on one of those Friday mornings, already well on his way out of town. Paul has not worked in an office in 30 years. And even that framing is a bit dishonest. In his career as a software developer, Paul has never really worked in what he calls a normal job. But his company, Art and Logic, has never had a formalized workspace and attributes that to their success with building a cohesive work culture. Still, Paul is wary of doling out business advice. He admits that what works for him might not work for anyone else, and that includes those inside the company he helps run, which is why he helped design Art and Logic to be truly flexible, and for the work to be completely and totally asynchronous. Paul's hikes are a part of that design. For him, finding time at the end of the week to get out in nature clears his mind and reduces stress. With his kids at school, he's not offloading the burden of care on his partner, nor does he have to be at work. The time is truly his. A number of the other 65 employees at the company have similarly unique schedules. 2 years ago, a graphic designer redesigned her schedule after the birth of her child. She works a stretch in the middle of the day and a stretch from roughly 7 to 10 in the evenings. She built the day so she could continue earning a living and doing what she loves, but also fulfill her desire to be the principal caregiver, which was equally important, he said. Another developer at the firm is an avid golfer and plays a few times a week. "I don't even know when he does it or how often, really," Paul said, "but I'm 100% confident that he'll make the time up when he wants to." It's entirely possible you're rolling your eyes while listening to this. Good for Paul and his 65 employees living in fantasy land. It might even piss you off a little. Friday hikes. Must be nice. Before the pandemic, you likely thought that sort of flexibility was probably all but impossible in your job. But a few months into working from home, you might have asked yourself, why do we ever think choosing one's hours or finding time to build work around hobbies or caregiving sounded like an extravagance? In many ways, breaking this cynical, closed mindset is the goal of this book. But it's difficult to imagine it if you can't see it or why it works. Art and Logic is an example of a flexible culture that works in service of its employees, including those at the top. Company and employee goals are established upfront and clearly communicated, part of the everyday work of what Paul describes as establishing reasonable expectations. Those expectations are designed to provide an understanding of what work is flexible and what, if any, needs to remain rigid. For example, employees are expected to be largely available during regular business hours, but can create schedules that work for them, provided they are upfront about it and hold to them. Art and Logic employees can work asynchronously because they are transparent about what needs to be done and who needs to do it, which in turn allows for more accountability. Theirs is a culture built on trust. Not the sort of empty phrase that shows up in mottos and job ads, but actual trust that employees will meet expectations. And part of that trust is granting real freedom to make small and occasionally large decisions about when work should be done. But the company also has a long-term strategy to match and accentuate that trust. They're focused not on immediate growth, but on long-term vision, retaining valuable employees in a competitive industry. The culture at Art and Logic can't be ported over to any company because there's no such thing as a magic formula. Culture naturally works differently at different scales. What works for a 60-person distributed software company might spell certain death for a 250,000-person global firm. But size doesn't ultimately matter when it comes to Art and Logic's cultural success. That's because they get the essential part of the company culture right. What the company says it's asking of employees and what it's actually asking, they're the same thing. So what makes for a healthy, flexible culture? Well, management. Not tacked-on management, throwaway management, old-school management, but management that meets the needs of the current moment. We have a few areas where you can begin to survey your existing management culture and ways to change it, but this isn't a checklist. It's a map. You can use it to find your own route. Just keep in mind, the changes your company needs are rarely the ones that jump out at you as the most straightforward. Find the section that makes you feel the most vulnerable, the most seen, the most broken and exhausted. That's where you need to start. Who's the manager? Melissa Nightingale and her husband Jonathan were among the first wave of employees hired at Mozilla in the first decade of the 21st century. They were young and didn't have a lot of experience, but like a lot of talented people who get in on the ground floor of a startup, they found themselves quickly rising through the company ranks. People just kept promoting them, giving them more managerial responsibility, even though they didn't understand what the hell they were supposed to be doing. Since 2017, the Nightingales have been working as a new sort of management consultant, specializing in growing companies. Every day, they spend time listening to how bad companies are at communicating and managing their employees. A lot of time. And then they try to fix it. It's usually not malice, Melissa told us, referring to the way most companies are run. It's ignorance. There are malicious actors out there, people acting out power fantasies. But a lot of the tactical stuff happens at the margins. The reason office work sucks is the same reason why remote work could also suck. It's because management sucks. In their positions at Mozilla, the first teams the Nightingales managed were scattered all over the world. Melissa and Jonathan were tasked with trying to coordinate their team's work while also avoiding assigning any tasks that would take place outside daylight hours in each employee's respective time zone. Back then, Slack didn't exist. Collaboration was really hard, Jonathan said. We were just kind of making it up, Melissa added. And we kept getting more and more mandates from our superiors. Finally, we hit this point where it was like, is anyone going to tell us how to do this job? The answer, they realized, was essentially no. They were alone. They looked around at other managers and realized that more often than not, new managers were plucked from non-management jobs, usually because they were quite good at what they did, and asked, do you want to be a manager? The move was always framed as a promotion and a big career advancement. The pay was better too. Most employees would say yes and then immediately find themselves in the managerial deep end with little or no training. They'd end up as shitty managers and make life shittier for everyone around them, Jonathan said. But again, it's not out of malice. It's out of ignorance. Nobody told them how to do it. This practice isn't limited to any industry, but the Nightingales argue it's especially pervasive at tech companies. For years, they'd read stories of dysfunctional startups and scandalous bad behavior coming from Silicon Valley and sigh, knowing that likely the problem has an easy but elusive fix. They started their company, Raw Signal, based out of Toronto, to try and diagnose the problem in the wild. But it was worse than they thought. For all the rhetoric around executive vision, the day-to-day experience of working at a company, the culture, the opportunities, the frustrations, was rarely dictated by those at the top. Instead, it was middle management, a person's direct manager, who set the tone for whether their job would feel like a daily experience of passive-aggressive warring or something collaborative, generative, and satisfying. Take, for example, maintaining anything approaching work-life balance during the pandemic. A skilled manager will approach each remote employee differently. They'll attempt to understand their employees' individual needs, how they work best away from the office, what stresses and pressures they have in their lives, and how to work around them. They'll offer trust and space, or attention and guidance, depending on the employee's needs. In short, they'll actively, dynamically manage. But most managers haven't been trained on how to navigate even small disruptions, let alone massive pandemic-induced ones. And without training, they often manage on one of two extremes. Either they micromanage needlessly because they know no other way to make their work visible or meaningful, or they treat managing the way their managers do, as an afterthought. Employees are left desperate for feedback, sending Slack messages into the wind. All of this was true before the pandemic, when people were largely working in the office. Remote work didn't create a new problem. It exacerbated an existing one. Which is why Melissa and Jonathan think the success of remote and flexible work will ultimately have little to do with the adoption of new technology or strategic organizational planning, or even the preferences of the CEO or the board of directors. It will live and die with middle management. When people talk about remote work, I hear, "We can work less and still be productive." And I'm like, okay, true. I'm excited. But if you're poorly managed, I can give you a 4-hour workday, 5 days a week, and burn you straight out, Melissa said. If I live in fear that if I don't have enough eye contact or enough Slack messages with my boss, I might get fired, working fewer hours will not help. And guess what? You won't even work fewer hours. You will compensate for precarity by over-delivering and burning out. And the problems go well beyond burnout. A lack of training creates a learned helplessness among mid-level managers. Instead of functioning as a sort of bulwark to protect employees, pushing back on bad decisions, they become passive vectors for what often clueless executives demand of them. Lack of good management allows inequities to grow and microaggressions to become macroaggressions. But how do you tell someone who's been doing a job for 5 years, maybe even 10, that they've missed the point of their job this whole time? People may be bad managers out of ignorance, but that doesn't mean they're blameless. There are pernicious, long-lasting effects to bad management. We've seen women who've had pay adjusted simply because a manager woke up, Jonathan said. The reason she was underpaid on the team was not because her boss was cackling in the corner. It was because nobody told the boss it was their responsibility to look at the fucking spreadsheet. As Melissa and Jonathan point out, if you're cashing the paycheck, it's time to find the training. You can't just experiment and figure out as you go on actual human beings. So what does that look like? It doesn't look like a single day offsite training session or a 2-hour webinar playing in the background while you scroll Twitter. Some of the work has to be simply realizing that in most modern organizations, management has become something to tack on to someone's existing job description, like a high school teacher getting extra money to coach high school volleyball. No matter they've only played a few games in their lives, somebody's got to do it. And hey, who doesn't want a pay bump? Alternately, management is used as a way to reward workers who distinguish themselves for their productivity, whether at sales, writing grants, data analysis, you name it. But as a recent study by Harvard Business Review pointed out, the skills associated with high productivity, including knowledge and expertise, driving for results, taking initiative, are almost all indications of individual-oriented competencies. Management requires skills that are other-oriented, being open to feedback, supporting colleagues' development, communicating well, having good interpersonal skills. Good managers are often productive. But productive people are not always good managers. They end up in those positions because most companies don't actually value good management enough to take the time to identify its qualities and then recruit and retain employees with them. This tendency to treat management as an add-on, as opposed to an actual job requiring a refined skill set, is, as the Nightingales found, rampant in startups, both new and long solidified. But it's also common in cash-strapped nonprofits, in academic departments, see department chairs, and in legacy companies that overcorrected the sprawling, management-heavy org charts of the 1960s and 1970s. Back then, people often dealt with bad management by expanding the org chart with even more badly trained managers. Now, we deal with it by ignoring it. Many of these companies view middle management as bloat, waste, what David Graeber would call a bullshit job. But that's because bad managing is waste. You're paying someone more money to essentially annoy everyone around them. And the more people experience that sort of bad management and think of it as just the way it is, the less they're going to value management in general. The key, then, is to think of how to treat management as a discrete, valuable skill, a deliverable that contributes to the overall value and resiliency of your organization. Otherwise, managers will continue to feel like dead weight, no matter how flexible an attitude you embrace. But before a company calls someone like the Nightingales or signs up for any other sort of management training, it's worth thinking about who's currently in management positions. How many people with no real aptitude or investment have taken on the responsibility because there's no other way to distinguish oneself? How many hate it? How many feel they'd love to devote more time to managing their team, but find they have so little time and space to dedicate to it beside their other work obligations? In other words, maybe some of your managers shouldn't be managers. Maybe you shouldn't be a manager. Maybe you're actually not a manager, have never thought of yourself as a manager, but actually have the aptitude for it. Managing has been pegged to promotion for so long, it's eclipsed what's actually vital about the position. It's not about power. It's about figuring out how to actually create the conditions for your team to do the best work. That work is often invisible, but your company should be treating it as invaluable. What does management look like now? People have felt adrift, anxious, and unmanaged in their work for years. So now it's time to reconsider what management's been missing and how to reintegrate it into the fully or flexibly remote future. Corinne Tan, Andrew Zhu, and Sid Pindia stumbled upon this realization almost by accident. All three spent their early careers with different startups. Pindia and Zhu worked in engineering and product, and Tan was in business development and marketing. Even when in an office, they noticed that their jobs were increasingly isolated, taking place primarily on screens. Coworkers were becoming abstractions, an email reply waiting to be answered instead of, well, a human being. They all found themselves interested in answering a fundamental question. If people actually understood each other's work style preferences, could they work together better? So they formed a company called Psych Insights to study remote work. In October 2019, they started reaching out to tech companies cold via LinkedIn with a few basic questions. What do you love or hate about remote work? They spoke with managers and low-level employees and C-suite executives from companies like Uber Eats, Glassdoor, Hubstaff, Evernote, and Mozilla. They were in the early stages of data analysis, and then the pandemic hit. It's crazy, Tan told us. We have this whole spectrum of data. At first, it's like, remote work is great. Then, whoa, a global pandemic changed everything. This is pretty stressful. And then, I onboarded at my company 6 months ago, and I've never met a single human I work with. The data Psych Insights collected offered a bleak picture. Over 90 hours of Zoom calls with 110 different companies and their employees, they found that most workplaces were buckling under the pressure of forced work from home. People were Zoom fatigued, but more than that, they were struggling to connect emotionally with their teams. Somebody we interviewed summed it up perfectly, Zhao said. They told us they were talking more and saying less. The emotional disconnect was creating anxiety, but also sucking all of the small, intangible joys out of the job. The cause was clear: management and a lack of emotional intelligence. They found that remote managers they surveyed had an average of about 4.87 direct reports. That might not sound like much, but it was overwhelming most managers as they attempted to deal with five different emotionally complex human beings, all under stress and with their own needs and demands. Worse yet, 21.5% of the remote managers they spoke with had less than 1 year of management experience when mandatory working from home began. they'd stumbled on the same problem as the Nightingales had. Managers were undertrained, underexperienced, overworked, and forced into a stressful new reality. As a result, everyone was suffering. To be a good manager, you need to be emotionally intelligent, Pandia told us. It's our whole company thesis. The emotional intelligence of the managers is what makes a company's culture miserable or excellent. It's hard to be emotionally intelligent when you're not in the same room. As a result, the trio saw that middle managers were absorbing much of the stress of their employees while also feeling pressure from higher-ups to make sure their teams felt cared for. Their attempt at a solution is Kona, a software platform that tries to measure the emotional health of employees working remotely and help managers establish an empathy-based communication. Every morning, Kona checks in with employees, asking them to evaluate their mood that day. Employees respond with a color. Green means feeling good. Yellow is ambivalent. Red suggests they're struggling. And are presented with the option to add more detail. The results are then shared with managers in order to synthesize what the Kona team described as a general vibe as to how people are feeling. Managers can also chart the emotional temperature of their team over time in order to arrive at a sense of how a project or a particular set of policies may affect the team. The platform also asks employees to answer questions about work style and then, if granted permission, uses artificial intelligence to analyze employee communication over platforms like public Slack channels. Kona then creates a personality profile of the employee that they can see and, if they want, make it public for other employees to use. The hope, the team told us, is that with enough honest data, Kona can help workers, especially managers, communicate more effectively in real time. Imagine you're typing out a message in Slack or writing an email, and Kona pops in and says, I see you're talking to Andrew and using a data-driven argument full of numbers, but our research shows that Andrew responds best to emotionally-driven arguments, Pandia said. He described other plausible scenarios, including Kona pops in to tell you that the email you're looping back on is not urgent, and in fact, Rebecca is currently in 6 hours of meetings and feeling stressed today. How about sending it tomorrow? A platform that feeds off the emotional data of employees is incredibly fraught. It could be abused by manipulative coworkers. There are real privacy considerations related to scanning public communication across corporate channels like Slack or calendar apps. Some employees might not mind telling a bot what their mood is for the day and won't hesitate to let others know when they feel like crap. Many will find it unnaturally, annoyingly invasive. But that, the founders argue, is exactly the point. Opacity and the lack of communication are at the very core of so many of today's management problems. Most people are flying blind, tiptoeing around their company, trying not to get fired, left to divine the emotions of their colleagues and superiors from vague blocks of text. If flexible work means less in-person contact than before, how do you ensure that people are still expressing and processing the small ticks, glances, postures, and belly laughs that function as the unofficial language of the in-person workplace? We talk about company culture all the time, but what we're talking about is so vague, Zhu said. Imagine actually being able to analyze your culture. Imagine you could show managers team health reports and trends and tie that to specific decisions they've made. It's a tantalizing idea indeed. Say an overzealous manager needlessly pushes up the due date of a project by a week, causing his employees to drop everything and crash it. The experience leads everyone to feel miserable, and the end result suffers. A platform like Kona would theoretically allow that manager, and the manager's manager, to trace these decisions and learn from them. This might feel niche right now, but companies will adapt to this kind of management, Pandia said. And 10 years from now, those who didn't embrace this hybrid style will look like dinosaurs. It'll be like companies in the early 2000s who saw the internet and said, pass. But this hybrid style, in which effective management becomes a mix of analytics and good old-fashioned human insight, is possible only if managers create an environment where, say, employees don't feel as if they just have to report their emotional state as green every day. And the managers are actually receptive to the story the accumulated data tells them, even if it runs counter to their own self-perception. Take the slightly less invasive example of Microsoft's Leadership Insights, available to managers in companies that use Microsoft Teams. Once enabled, the leadership page allows managers to track how much one-on-one time they've allocated with each member of their team, team meeting links and characteristics, And when your team's quiet hours, aka times when they're authentically not online and working, naturally fall. Managers can't see how many emails you're sending or precisely what sort of work you're doing, just that you're logged onto Teams and using it. The information can help managers be more honest with themselves about their own management behavior. You think that you run focus meetings, but the leadership page shows that you're multitasking in 75% of them, an indication, according to a previous Microsoft study, that the rest of your team is as well. You might think you're checking in regularly and equally with all of your employees. The analytics will report back whether that's the case. One manager who works as a librarian told us that for her, the analytics, particularly around quiet hours, have been eye-opening. She used to reserve between 5 and 7 p.m. for attending to emails, but the analytics showed that her emails were consistently interrupting her team's quiet hours, time when they had stepped away from work, and pulling them back in. Now she still sends her emails between 5 and 7 p.m., but she schedules them all for the morning, during her team's active hours. She had a choice. Keep telling herself, as many managers do, that her team understood they didn't have to immediately read and respond to emails sent after hours. Or look at the data and see that they were still reading and responding during those times and change her behavior accordingly. The secret to good culture and even good management isn't some weekend offsite or even a fancy piece of technology. As Tan put it, there's no way to ping pong table or happy hour your way out of it. Analytics won't magically turn you into a better manager. You can use them to inform and transform your own behavior, but only if you actually have a vested interest in managing with more empathy and intentionality. We're all figuring out what our jobs are going to look like in this new reality. And if we do it on our own, remote work will continue to look like the anxious, endless jumble of the pandemic year. The process is going to require a significant amount of experimentation, grace, communication, and transparency. But the way we help each other do it, especially as managers, is to understand that everyone up and down the org chart is a full, messy, complex, vulnerable, and struggling human in need of support, affirmation, and boundaries. You can teach others that posture, but you also have to learn it for yourself. Kill the monoculture. In 2020, 92.6% of CEOs on the Fortune 500 were white. A survey conducted that same year of more than 40,000 workers at 317 companies found that while white men make up just 35% of the entry-level workforce, they compose 66% of the C-suite. For every 100 men who were promoted to manager, only 58 black women and 71 Latina women were promoted. Only 38% of respondents in entry-level management positions were women of any race. You've heard these statistics or something approximating them before. No matter how many diversity, equity, and inclusion workshops your organization requires, if your leaders and managers aren't truly diverse, then the monoculture will prevail. The word monoculture comes from the agricultural world, where it's used to describe growing or raising one specific type of crop or animal. Businesses don't grow crops, but they do yield workers. Every organization knowingly and unknowingly creates conditions in which a certain type of worker will thrive. In most companies, the profile of that worker is the same as the profile of the person set up to thrive in most situations in America. White, male, educated, middle class, congenial, sociable, and able to delegate obligations outside of the office to others, whether in the form of a partner, a parent, or paid labor. Left to its own devices, monoculture will self-sow and replicate itself endlessly. The things that a white male, for example, might understand as the hallmarks of good leadership and good management are the things that feel like good leadership and management to him. Characteristics that can manifest themselves in everything from standards of professionalism to tone of voice. He will naturally promote, elevate, or otherwise privilege workers with those attributes and marginalize or ignore those without them. Frequently, those perpetuating the monoculture aren't even aware they're doing it. But this is how monoculture persists, people endlessly promoting people like them for the rest of time. In the ag world, years of monoculture eventually suck all the nutrients from the soil. Farmers require more and more fertilizer and pesticide to keep harvest levels high. The entire process wreaks havoc on the ecosystem. Why do they keep doing it? Usually because it's cheaper and easier. They focus on the short-term effects rather than the long-term devastation that will eventually put them and their families out of business. It's not just that the soil is wrecked. The yields decline too. Some businesses have slowly realized as much when it comes to their own version of monoculture. Maybe it's good, they start to think, even invigorating and generative, to have a company that's not filled with people with the same life experience. You can see the growing popularity of this idea all over consultant reports and business publications, which have filled with phrases like, diversity is profitable. The relationship between diversity and business performance persists, and the business case for diversity is overwhelming. This business case for diversity developed alongside growing societal pressure to address social and racial justice within the workplace. Many companies responded by adopting some version of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, corporate speak for efforts to not only expand the diversity of hires and employees, in all senses of the word, but also to make the workplace less toxic for those same employees. Some workplaces have a head of DEI. Others outsource workshops and trainings to the multi-billion dollar DEI industry. In 2020, Bain launched a DEI consultancy with more than 24 staff available to beam down into companies willing to pay for their services. The head of the department, Julie Kaufman, called diversity, quote, the next digital. The success of these efforts has, perhaps unsurprisingly, been mixed. Even companies that manage to successfully recruit diverse candidates are often horrible at retaining them. What's more, consultancies like Bain often frame success in terms of achievable metrics. For example, percentage of diverse candidates interviewed for a position that don't actually require any form of substantive change to the way a company works, particularly when it comes to leadership. A pair of studies from 2007 and 2016 found that firms with some form of DEI training did not, in fact, hire significantly more diverse managers and actually decreased the number of black female managers. When you conceptualize diversity as something you add onto an existing monoculture, chances are high those employees will always feel as if they were somehow on the outside of it. And when you treat DEI as a module to complete, you can blind yourself to the way your company fails to integrate its ethos into basic day-to-day operations. One woman told us about attending a DEI workshop where the conference room scheduled for the event was not wheelchair accessible. A colleague in a wheelchair was asked to listen in from just outside the door. Another woman recalled a DEI-branded meeting during Black History Month where the only speakers were white. A professor described a DEI committee at her college with no funding and little support from her college's dean. Attendance at DEI faculty workshops was not mandatory, and as such, poorly attended, usually by the same group of small people. The women on the committee performed all of the work. It felt, in the words of one committee member, like functional window dressing. Stories in this vein are everywhere. They aren't just anecdotal blunders. They're evidence of a holistic misconceptualization of DEI, in which trainings and metrics ultimately function as a panacea for white guilt instead of a blueprint for enduring cultural change. So long as companies continue to approach diversity within this framework, they'll continue to waste time, money, and employee patience. The shift to remote and flexible work won't solve the problem entirely, not even close. But it can begin to disassemble structures that have long felt immovable and start to build new, unexpected, more inclusive ones in their place. Before the pandemic year, Stephanie Nadi Olson would regularly encounter this sort of attitude in her meetings with huge companies, sprawling ad agencies, tech giants, retail conglomerates that were attempting to grapple with the DEI problem. Right before lockdown, my last business trip was to meet with two tech companies, she said, and I told them, you cannot look at me and say you care about having a diverse, world-class organization and also say that everyone who works for you has to move to Seattle. When Olson gave companies that advice pre-COVID, their eyes would glaze over and they'd nod politely and do nothing. But the combination of the pandemic and the renewed call for substantive corporate action when it comes to social justice and hiring has shifted their position. COVID has given them permission, Olson told us. They can see that remote work is possible and a real way to address their DEI problem. Olson's solution feels almost like a cheat code. Her organization, We Are Rosie, works as a 21st century version of the long and short-term temp firm, connecting more than 6,000 workers in the marketing field with companies and agencies across the world. Some of these Rosies, as employees are called, work for a few weeks on a pop-up project at an organization. Some work on political campaigns. Others become long-term placements at legacy organizations, from Bloomberg to Procter & Gamble. But We Are Rosie is not a traditional subcontractor. It takes the reality of the existing fissured workplace and attempts to stabilize it for its employees. Rosies can be remote and work from wherever they want. They can find actual part-time work that still pays well. They have a robust online support community. And if a company tries to cut corners on their contract, treat them poorly, or change the parameters of the project they've been hired to complete, they have an external advocate whose primary interest is retaining the Rosies, not the client. The result? A workforce that's more than 90% remote, more than 40% Black, Indigenous, and people of color, or BIPOC, with 99% gender pay equity. Some Rosies are moms who spent years struggling to find meaningful work that was legitimately part-time, instead of 20 hours that always turned into 40 or more. Some are veterans with PTSD that made it difficult for them to commit to full-time work in places outside their own homes. Some live in rural areas they don't want to leave because their community, or their partner's job, or the proximity to family. What they share is simple. They've been overlooked or underappreciated by the monocultures in various industries. But that didn't mean their work wasn't valuable. We Are Rosie combines the positive attributes of flex, especially in regard to diversity and inclusion, while protecting against the exploitation and instability that so often accompany it. To do so, the leaders at We Are Rosie have fostered an environment in which their workers feel empowered and supported when they speak up. First, the diversity of the team mirrors the sort of diversity they want to attract among members. Their headquarters is in Atlanta, not on the coasts. The founder is the daughter of a Palestinian refugee. She grew up in a multilingual, multi-religion home. We're activist-oriented in our marketing, and our newsletter and communication is activist-oriented, Olson told us. It creates an environment for Rosies that makes them feel comfortable bringing something to us. It's not uncommon, for example, for someone to have an interview with a client and for them to come back to us and say, "Hey, because you're so loud about your values, I know that this client and this individual doesn't seem aligned with them." In several cases, this has meant We Are Rosie passing on a client. This business is a mechanism for the distribution of access and opportunities and wealth to people who have traditionally not had access to those things, Olson said. We just always have to do the right thing. There are big companies where we have Rosies and have to keep the conversation going about whether it's the right thing. The problem, Olson says, is that a lot of the leaders at these companies are trying as best as they can to just ride this shit out. They're spectacularly eager to rubber band back to the way things were before, location-bound, obsessed with presentism, equating leadership material with constant availability, still thinking of DEI as something that can be solved with a committee. They'd never admit it, but they want to preserve the monoculture. Olson knows she can't change the minds of these 63-year-old white male CEOs, but she can make it very easy to connect their organizations with workers who would otherwise be shut out of them. There's a dark scenario, of course, in which monoculture is allowed to persist in the office among full-time employees who show up every day and continue to rise through the ranks while diversity gets subcontracted out to people across the country, or, as has been the case in these call centers, executive assistants and more across the globe for far, far less money. Which means that an organization could hire some Rosies, but what they really need is to be more like We Are Rosie itself, hiring and retaining diverse workers up and down the org chart and engendering trust that they're not just shouting about their values for PR effect, but attempting to live them. We Are Rosie was founded in 2018 and built DEI into its DNA from the beginning. Most companies are battling years, if not an actual century or more, of monoculture. To shift that legacy, you have to survey its contours and crannies. Do what For the Culture, an equity and culture shift firm founded by four women of color, calls SEE. Identify and articulate the current organizational climate so that you can start to think about what shifts are needed. But a lot of organizations are resistant to actually seeing themselves clearly. Folks have the best intentions, trying to figure out how to respond to chaos or tension or shifts in culture, Nia Martin Robinson, one of the founders of For the Culture, told us. And people think, if I can find this DEI consultant, if I can just get this training for my staff, then everything will be better. So they come to us and they say, we just want the training. And we say, we need to chat with your staff. We need to figure out the primary cohorts. We need to figure out what you'll actually need. When DEI isn't seen as mission critical, it becomes a sort of mission add-on, Sabrina Lacani, another For the Future co-founder, explained. Training will only get you so far. It doesn't change the inequities. This type of accounting looks like the stats that open this chapter. Who holds the leadership positions? What's the difference between the percentages that make up entry-level positions, management, and higher leadership? Ignore the longitudinal data for now. You might have increased underrepresented groups in management by 10% from last year, but that might have just meant going from zero BIPOC managers to one. Once you've established a baseline, you need to get more granular and detailed in your conception of diversity. Too often, executives take the wrong approach here and begin to try to collect an employee from every race. Instead, try the following questions. Is everyone in management able-bodied? Do you have a mix of parents and non-parents, straight parents and LGBTQ plus parents? Is the majority of your workforce from one generation? What percentage graduated from Ivy League schools, from HBCUs? Maybe you've upped the number of women in the C-suite, but are all of those women white? The point isn't just upping your diversity metrics for the annual report or to fulfill some consultancy-approved metric. It's also not trying to perfectly match every person with a manager who has a similar background or life experience. The point is continuing to dilute the sort of monoculture that makes it so difficult for hires to thrive. Which means, in many cases, relinquishing the idea of what the office should look like and how it should operate. As Martin Robinson points out, companies are often eager to transform, but incredibly resistant to thinking of that transformation as letting go of old hierarchies, old pathways to power, old understandings of what productivity should look like. Getting rid of the monoculture isn't just about hiring or promoting people. It's about figuring out how to organizationally shift the locus of power and control away from those who've had it, without question, for so long. This is, in a sense, a radical change when it comes to power dynamics inside companies. And the process will likely create some sort of tension. But it's wrong to think of these changes one-dimensionally, as a power grab or an overthrow of an old regime. That kind of thinking is zero-sum, destined to fail, and not how inclusion actually works. Getting rid of the monoculture sounds like a deletion, but it's actually an addition. Inclusion means adding voices, which is precisely where the process derives its power and value. Diversity and inclusion aren't about ripping all status and privilege from one group and conferring it to another. They're about balance. It's not just We Are Rosie, after all, that's able to recruit monoculture castoffs. It's distributed companies like Doist, which has employees in 30 countries across the world and a 97% retention rate because the job descriptions are legitimately flexible and don't require workers to show up every day in an office. It's organizations like The 19th, which understood that the only way to recruit journalists who could make their coverage truly intersectional was to allow them to live in and cover the communities they called home. If you legitimately cast your net wider, you're going to get more fish eager to swim into it. But to keep them around, you also have to keep illuminating and dismantling the monoculture. That means considering all the unspoken norms that ossified around the culture that was. Expectations for work socialization, how to solicit advice, how to climb the organizational hierarchy. Many of these ideas have been so thoroughly normalized that unless you've struggled to fit within them, it's difficult to see just how exclusionary they can feel. Offices, for example, are naturally social. And while that's not necessarily a negative quality, the social rhythms of many American workplaces, even the most progressive ones, tend to have vestigial elements of that predominantly white, predominantly male, and middle-class workforce of the organization man era. Socializing, especially after work, is often centered on alcohol and caters to workers who don't have care obligations and are adept or comfortable with small talk. Take the example of Helen, who told us 8 months into the pandemic that she's never been happier at work. As an employee at a Bay Area tech startup, she found her work didn't change very much when the pandemic hit. The transition was more seamless than expected. What did change, though, was her relationship to the company's culture. "I'm a total introvert and just much more comfortable this way," Helen said. Before the pandemic, she struggled with in-person office tasks and interactions. Unlike more gregarious coworkers, she worried that perhaps she seemed aloof. Worse, there was the nagging concern that she wouldn't be recognized or come to mind. To prevent being potentially left behind, she attended after-work functions she hated, missing out on precious time with her family in order to have awkward conversations. And for what? The company was using post-work functions to provide the connective tissue that management should have provided. She was continuously bending herself toward her company's idea of culture, and the contortions were exhausting. But after the pandemic sent everyone home from the office, her company's culture started to bend towards her. Instead of attending an anxiety-inducing, stilted meeting, Helen was able to participate virtually in team discussions. She began to feel less guarded. Instead of second-guessing each proposal or question, she built up small reserves of confidence. She started leading more in non-work conversations. She became active in a Slack channel her office started for working moms, which was programmed to prompt participants every Thursday to respond with how they're doing by posting a GIF. "Sounds silly, right? Like it wouldn't work? But it's amazing," she said. "It's this wonderful thread of moms, and it's funny, it's emotional, and it really has turned into something greater than we thought. It's a genuine way for me to have a personal connection with people I didn't know that doesn't require live, face-to-face interaction." In our days at our previous employer, the social culture mainly revolved around full days staring at a computer screen, followed by late evenings at the bar. The informal outings were mostly impromptu and by no means mandatory, but in a small company, they were invaluable ways to bond with coworkers. As new employees, we learned that after-work gossip over drinks was the only way to figure out what was actually going on at the company, which managers were fickle, who was kind of a creep, and who was on thin ice. Just because it wasn't about work or didn't take place at work doesn't mean it was wholly separate from work. Those who didn't show up at the crappy bar for overpriced gin and tonics weren't ostracized, but like Helen, they could feel at a disadvantage, or as if they were doing something wrong, simply because their personality didn't match the de facto culture. "I am not a fan of the happy hour," Helen's coworker Sheila told us, "and it's been a really amazing development to find new ways to bring traditionally physical interactions into the virtual space." Sheila thinks of herself as more extroverted, and she and her colleagues have ordered at-home meal kits and taken group cooking classes over Zoom. They use a Slack tool called Donut, which randomly matches willing participants and schedules a one-on-one meeting for them to talk about anything, work-related or not. Some of these ideas can, at least at first, feel artificial or gimmicky, but they're no more or less so than the implicit expectation to meet in a bar after hours, and they're far more inclusive. They're also not a one-to-one replacement. The point isn't to ban happy hours. It's to stop making them the most valued mode of connection. Sheila also appreciates how remote work has helped her juggle the different components of her identity, as a professional, as a mom of two, and as a woman of color. "I always felt so much pressure, wanting to be a mom and fully focused on work and figuring out how to turn those things on and off," she said. "But I found the load is so much lighter working from home. I see it less as work-life balance and more as work-life fluidity." The monoculture at Helen and Sheila's company had privileged a certain type of in-person, after-work interaction. The pandemic broke that culture down and replaced it, at least partially, with one that helped highlight their strengths. But the shift to remote can also allow other standards, particularly the arbitrary and often very white and very cisgendered ones of professionalism, to recede as well. When the journalist Chika Ekemeze first began interviewing women of color who had made the shift to working from home during the pandemic, she was interested in the ways that remote work liberated Black women workers from white standards of professionalism in their offices. "I've long been a believer that professionalism is just a synonym for obedience," she wrote. "The less social capital you have, the more you are tethered to professionalism. It's why Mark Zuckerberg can wear the same t-shirt to work, while Black women are punished for wearing braids." Ekemeze echoes the work of sociologist Cassie Pittman Clater, who, pre-pandemic, found that Black office workers, particularly those at companies with few Black employees, often grappled with internalized pressure to groom and conduct themselves as exemplars. For the sake of their careers, they try to become more put together than their white counterparts and take far more care with their appearance, Clater observed. They describe wearing dress pants when their colleagues are wearing khakis. While they are sure to wear clothing that is always clean and pressed, they describe white colleagues as wearing clothes that are wrinkled or have holes. But working from home, as Ekemeze put it, has provided an opportunity for black women to flourish outside of the expectations of professionalism, simply by nature of not being hyper-visible and held to standards that weren't designed for us. Some women told her they'd embraced a less formal wardrobe and less makeup. Others felt freer to wear bonnets or wigs on days when they didn't want to spend time on their hair. Surveys conducted during the first 10 months of the pandemic illustrate the complex relationship that BIPOC employees have to remote work. Data collected by Slack's Future Forum showed that black employees were working longer hours and experiencing higher stress around pressure to perform, a sign of a lack of mutual trust between the employees and the managers. But overall, black employees expressed a 29% increase in feelings of satisfaction and belonging working remotely, compared with being primarily in the office. One reason for this, respondents said, was that working from home meant less code switching or pressure to modulate their behavior for a boss or a coworker. As workers' offices moved into their homes, though, some began to feel the standards of professionalism extend to judgments about personal spaces. What do my books, my art, my clutter communicate about my competence as a worker? Who's able to professionalize their home spaces for remote appearances, and who's trying to angle the camera so that the colleagues can't tell they're zooming from the bedroom? Which employees feel empowered to say, screw it, I don't care what my background is, and who is spending outsized time thinking about it? The less privilege and power you have in an organization, the more these things matter. If you personally don't feel that they matter, chances are high you're observing from a place of stability or power, a place, as Ekemeze put it, with a lot of social capital. In a roundtable discussion 6 months into the pandemic, Tamara Mose, a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the director of DEI at the American Sociological Association, purposely set up her workspace so that her background was a blank white wall. She didn't want her home surroundings and what they might have seemed to communicate about her to become part of the interactions with students and colleagues. But not everyone has access to a blank wall. One easy solution? Standardize Zoom backgrounds, playful or serious, as the way you do remote work. Allow workers to turn their cameras off in scenarios in which face-to-face communication isn't necessary. And continue to rethink when face-to-face communication is necessary. Embracing remote work can help break down the monoculture, but only if you remain vigilant to the ways that it can also reproduce it. Until you can recognize that, efforts at creating a truly inclusive work culture will continue to fail. Inclusivity cannot stop at happy hour alternatives. Understanding and attending to the needs of people with different abilities, different home lives, different work styles, all of it is a part of the work of breaking the monoculture. The disabled community has been waiting for companies to wake up to this need for years, while its members have advocated for more truly flexible work options. But now that they've been thrust on the workforce at large, it's time to actually understand all the ways that accommodations actually work. Stephen Aquino has been covering the technology industry from California for the last 8 years. Before that, he was a preschool teacher, but his cerebral palsy made it difficult to meet the physical needs of his students day in and day out. He looked for something he could do, ideally from home, that would be less physically taxing. He found it in writing and reporting. That shift to working from home really changed who I am, Aquino said. I'm not always so tired anymore. Because I'm not so exhausted and hurting and thinking about it all the time, I've been able to concentrate on doing work I enjoy and take pride in. Working from home also helped with Aquino's social anxiety, which was exacerbated by his stutter. Still, the rhetoric of the current moment and the opportunities of flexible work have felt, in his words, disorienting. We're in a society where diversity and inclusion is a big subject right now, he said. And it's inspiring to see, but it isn't evenly distributed. We talk about inclusion, and then people like me are always off to the side, way over there. It's been hard to hear people saying, oh my God, I've been trapped at home, and I've had to change my entire life, and I'm stuck with my kids, and I've had to learn Zoom, Aquino told us. I sit here and think, yeah, it is hard. You're finally seeing what people like me have had to do. Members of the disabled community have spent years trying to force, plead, sue, or kindly request workplaces to become more accessible. And now, people are complaining that remote tech is bad and no one knows how to manage boundaries? The disability advocate and inclusion consultant, Andrea Levant, spends a lot of time trying to communicate a very basic message. Having a disabled person on your team isn't a cost, but a benefit. It's going to benefit everyone because we see life through a different lens, Levant said. And if we add other intersectional lenses, well, me as a Black disabled woman, you're going to get a whole different perspective. Companies think that accommodations have to be expensive, Levant continued, even though the average accommodation before the pandemic was less than $500 a person. But they still think extra. They think physical accommodation. If you ask for something out of the norm or out of the standard of what has already been supplied, they assume you're going to cost them a lot of money. But what's happened with the pandemic has proven just how straightforward inclusivity can actually be. It often means expanding the standards for able-bodied people and adopting components of universal design. Take, for example, the conferences and networking events from the pandemic year, all of which were moved online, made accessible, in other words, to people who often could not attend them for whatever reason in the past, because of either mobility issues, care demands, location, or cost. Sure, they might not feel as intimate or exclusive, but that's the point. Actual accessibility means letting go of bullshit arguments whose ultimate purpose is preserving the status quo. Is something lost in our interactions when they move out of the physical world and online? Likely, yes. But that loss dominates the conversation at the expense of what so many, especially those previously unable to participate, gain. Universal design, in physical offices, in remote tech, in the way we conceive of communication, is the anti-monoculture. It's not as expensive as people fear. It's not as disruptive as people imagine. But it requires everyone involved believing that the more you expand the number of people you can allow at the table, the more you actually value those people, the better as an organization that you'll be. Better at understanding the broad base of people that your organization serves, in whatever capacity, but also better at reducing employee turnover, and better at fostering creativity and collaboration. Who doesn't benefit from a captioned meeting or a transcript, Levant asked. It's not just helpful for a deaf person or someone who has a neurocognitive disability. There are so many benefits to universal design in physical workplaces. I mean, why do you think so many people want to use the disabled stall? It's better. Some companies have already figured out what it feels like, building a diverse, equitable, and inclusive culture, either from scratch or on the rubble of the industrial monoculture that preceded it. Their argument, like Levant's, is pretty simple. It's just better. You're not a family. Valerie is an Australian expat, currently living on the outskirts of London, who found her way to nonprofit work after a toxic experience in the corporate world. She currently works as a fundraiser for a nonprofit organization that does significant outreach work in the community. She enjoys her job because, in her words, I can see what is achieved through the money I raise. But Valerie's previous experience in the corporate world taught her the necessity of maintaining distance between her work and her identity, which requires pushing against the culture of her company. Like every arts and charity organization, there's a real stated culture that we're a family and we're all working together to achieve something, she told us. And like every other organization, what that means in real terms is that you're expected to push yourself and you end up overworked. Chera, a professor in Virginia, has endured similar messaging from her university, which describes itself as being like a family, which usually just means expecting them to do more with less, while highly competent people are being consistently burdened with extra work and underperformers slide by. Shelby, who works at an architectural firm in Texas, said that her company likes to talk about how its people are its biggest asset, and of course that they're like family. I think we're a somewhat dysfunctional family, if that, she said. We're still learning how not to be an old boys' club. The problem isn't that these companies are wrong in calling their employees family. Many organizations are evoking, reproducing, and incentivizing relationships that all feel familial. But family relationships can just as easily be manipulative, passive-aggressive, and endlessly confusing. Family members can be racist, exploitative, sexist, transphobic, and emotionally abusive. But because they're family, it's often considered impolite or uncivil to confront them about the very real injuries that they do to others. As the comedian Kevin Farzad put it on Twitter, if an employer ever says, "We're like family here," what they mean is they're going to ruin you psychologically. Don't mistake us. Families can be loving, compassionate, and endlessly supportive. So too can the companies that aspire to behave like them. But you already have a family, chosen or otherwise. And when a company uses that rhetoric, it is reframing a transactional relationship as an emotional one. It might feel enticing, but it is deeply manipulative, and more often than not, a means to narrativize paying people less to do more work. Family evokes not just a closeness, but a devotion and a lasting bond, infused with sacrifice. Family comes first. Treating your organization as a family, no matter how altruistic its goals, is a means of breaking down boundaries between work and life, between paid labor and the personal. When you're assaulted by powerful feelings of familial obligations from all sides, your actual family, but also your managers and your colleagues, it's all the more difficult to prioritize. And in these situations, your actual family, which is often more forgiving, more malleable, and more attuned to your needs, will always suffer. The rhetoric of workplace family has developed over the course of the last half century, but is often meant to evoke a bygone, romanticized notion of a simpler way to do business. Dr. Sarah Tabor, a crop consultant who has worked in farming for more than 20 years, argues that the business of agriculture has helped perpetuate the false stereotype of the family business by portraying family farms as an agrarian, utopian ideal. We're sold this idea that sure, life may be screwed up, but if we can just get back to the old ways, we'd be saved, and that somehow offices are responsible for the death of work-life balance, she told us. That's just not true. In reality, Tabor argues, family farms are just as hierarchical, patriarchal, and exploitative of workers. She points to the historian Caitlin Rosenthal's book, Accounting for Slavery, which traces how early slave plantation farms developed many of the management and accounting practices that still structure corporate life. The early agrarian economy was ruthless. It was also a family business. And the abolition of slavery didn't magically destroy the power imbalances present in agriculture, even on family farms. Working on a family farm means working in somebody's home, she argues. There are tremendous gaps in wealth and status and power. Put differently, there is no work environment immune to abuse, even in industries that don't toil under fluorescent lights. The workplace family is built as a way to engender cohesion and community, but often it works as a means to distract or compel workers to ignore their own exploitation. It's a subtle means of discouraging requests for raises and time off, dismissing complaints about coworker behavior, and deflecting managerial malfeasance. It dissolves the best attempts at boundaries, and it's used to excuse the inexcusable, sexual harassment, massive pay discrepancies, and the enduring whiteness of management. You can and should cultivate a workplace where people feel supported and valued, but you cannot be a family. So how do you break that dynamic? Distance and boundaries. This is what the genuinely flexible work future can provide. A means to separate yourself from your workplace, and the space to cultivate and grow a personality, relationships, and community outside the labor you do for pay. Organizations of every size and shape are always trying to figure out the most desirable, most effective perks their budgets allow, when the easiest one is right there in front of them. They can give their employees the immeasurable gift of a schedule and flexibility that will permit them a world away from work and lift the psychological burden of that second family from their shoulders. A healthy work culture creates the circumstances for all employees to do their very best work, but a sustainable, resilient one understands and eagerly invites them to have lives outside of it.